So, as Ataketu said, I do have quite a strong connection with Buddha Shakyamuni, as I'll come on to in a little while. So I'm very, very pleased to be giving this talk. When Ataketu asked me, there was no question of me saying no, because I'm going to be talking about the Buddha, and I'm going to be talking here at Padmaloka, and both of which are very dear to my heart indeed. And I thought, how appropriate it is to be speaking about the Buddha, standing before what I think is quite an iconic image for our movement, an image of Shakyamuni, the Buddha, not just the historical Buddha, but also, when you look at it, it gives a whiff of the Buddha which is beyond space and time, the Buddha which attained final nibbana at his physical death over 2,500 years ago. So I'm very pleased to be giving the talk standing before the Buddha, quite literally if you close your eyes and use your imagination. So 12 years ago, within the context of a simple yet to me deeply profound ceremony conducted by Surata, I was privately ordained into the Sri Ratna Buddhist Order here at Padmaloka. And during the ceremony, Surata gave me a practice to visualise and contemplate Shakyamuni Buddha. And this was on the basis of a growing relationship with the Buddha, which had begun very unexpectedly several years before my ordination on a retreat at Vajraloka, our retreat centre in North Wales. This happened more than once, but during absorbed meditation, the Buddha appeared to me just as you are now. You know, it wasn't daydreaming. The Buddha appeared to me just as you are now on three different occasions. And just sat with me and gave me something of his presence. And as Surata took me through the ordination ceremony, the Buddha seemed to be with me again, quite clearly sitting behind Surata. And during my ordination ceremony, actually, which took place in the garden shed up at the top of the garden, I had a very strong sense that I was about to step into a lineage, a living lineage made up of all of those who have practiced and transmitted the Dharma since the death of the Buddha, and that from Surata to Sangharakshita to Sangharakshita's teachers, and so on, right back to the Buddha. And my ordination ceremony, part of which I was stepping in to this lineage very, very strongly, and that gave me a great sense of confidence that the Buddha was there. But the influence of the Buddha is available to us all, me and you, everybody. And we just have to open up to that influence. And I believe if we open up to that influence, this can be a great benefit to not just ourselves, but for the world as well. The world needs, as we often say, the world does need the Dharma. And we can open up through study, through meditation, through puja, through reflection, through friendship, and so on. And I cannot recommend enough. If you ever get the chance to go on pilgrimage, go. It really does bring the Buddha alive. And I think it's important that we do form a connection with the Buddha. He must mean something to us. To live the Buddhist life, to become like the Buddha, we must imagine him. If we're not enlightened, well, I'm not enlightened, so I have to imagine what the enlightened mind, how the enlightened mind would view the world. So my connection with the Buddha is very much through the imagined faculty. So the goal must be embodied in our imaginations, if you like. And Subhuti wrote in a recent paper to the Order called Reimagining the Buddha. He says, unless we can truly imagine the Buddha and his enlightenment in a way that stirs us deeply, we cannot mobilise our energies to go for refuge to him. We cannot close the gap between who we are and perhaps how we'd like to be, as represented by the kindness and the wisdom and ethicality of the Buddha, if you like. And of course, there's many, many ways to do this. There's many ways to open ourselves up to the influence of the Buddha. But I haven't got time to explore that. It's beyond the remit of this talk. Because in this talk, I want to consider incidents from the Buddha to be, journey to enlightenment that particularly strike me. And I'm not going to give you immense details about a particular instance. I'm going to introduce a particular incident with a couple of lines maybe, and then give a narrative on that, because you can go to the Pali Canon and read for yourself the Buddha's account of his journey into enlightenment. What I'm going to try and do with this talk is make it as practical as possible, and then for you to go off and fill in the details, if you like. And I hope that you find at least some of the talk useful. So, the Buddha to be, as we know, belonged to the Shakya clan and within the tribe of the Gotamas. And Gotama is the Buddha's surname, or the Buddha's to be surname. We don't actually know his first name. Tradition calls him Siddhartha, but in the Pali Canon, you only find Gotama. So Gotama, the Buddha. And as we know, as well as many of us know, his father was a chief minister and a warrior. And his father raised Gotama with fine food, entertainment, fine garments, access to the finest physicians and educators of the day, and training in martial arts and warfare, and so on. In other words, Gotama was raised in relative luxury. Now, some people can think, that's not me. I'm not raised in relative luxury. Maybe you're not. But I would say that very, very many of us living in the West are actually living in luxury. We enjoyed unparalleled life expectancy. We have unparalleled medical and dietary knowledge in order to prolong our lives and to alleviate pain, or at least put it off. The outcome set it off. We have painkillers. We have dentistry. We have anaesthetics. We have easy access to doctors. We have easy access to hospitals when things go wrong. That is luxury to me. We also can eat the finest foods. And, you know, we don't have to go and grow them. We don't have to dig them up. We can just go to Asda. Or a Whole Foods shop. We can just nip down to the supermarket. We have the welfare state. And we have gadgets that provide us with more leisure and pleasure. Washing machines. iPods. iPads. Vast bodies of literature. Sexual freedom. And the list just goes on. But for many of us, or certainly for me when I was growing up as a kid, what on offer is not enough. It didn't, for me, when I was about 14, when I had a kind of an existential crisis, what was on offer, it didn't speak to my deepest longings. I was restless and I wanted something more. And perhaps that's why you're here today. Perhaps that's why you have started to investigate Buddhism. Traditionally, the experiences that led Gotama on his quest, as many of us know, are called the four sights, and those are old age, sickness, death, and the sight of a religious mendicant. And we are told, in the scriptures anyway, that in sequential journeys beyond the palace walls, in his chariot, driven by his charioteer, of course, the Gotama saw for the first time in his life ever an old man, and then a sick man, a party carrying a dead body, and then the Sramana, or the religious mendicant, all of which had a profound impact upon the young prince. Now, whether the story of the four sights is actually based on fact or not, to me, is missing the point. You know, I've led many study groups where people say, that you can't take them literally. You're missing the point, I think. The point is that they represent a point in Gotama's life where the facts of life had really sunk in. And what the facts of life include: old age, sickness and death. They had really pierced him to the core. He knew that no one, not him, his wife, his child, his father, all those dear to him, could escape these three facts of life. And it's like those 3D models, you know. Maybe we don't see the image at first, but then when we look really, really carefully, we find the image. And that may be what happened to Gotama. He was looking at life, and then he looked at it so piercingly that he saw the truths of impermanence as represented by old age, sickness and death. Once he'd seen them, of course, he could not look at life again and not see them. And he speaks about the futility of trying to find complete satisfaction in things that cannot give what he sought. And he sought some kind of permanent refuge. And also he was struck by how people around him did not see the three sights for themselves. He says, "I considered how most people feel fearful, humiliated and disgusted when they come across old age, sickness and death in others. Forgetting, and this is the important bit, that they are subject to these things themselves. For myself, such a reaction did not seem fitting. And with this insight, all the intoxication of youth faded utterly from my heart." So Gotama could not carry on living as he was living, having seen these three sights. And of course, the three sights are all around us today. They're right here now. You know, they're right here now. You may have had a headache, which you didn't have 2 minutes ago. You may have a little pain in your knee, which you didn't have 2 minutes ago. You know, these little reminders that the human body is vulnerable, and nothing stays the same. But what is my response to when we see the three sights? What is your response? Do we still carry on doing as what we do? Or do we think more about what we are doing with our lives? So eventually Gotama, like the Shramana in the fourth sight, the man who had looked so peaceful and so serene to Gotama, the man who seemed to represent something which would bring the deepest satisfaction to Gotama's heart, Gotama went in search of an alternative, as represented by this wandering mendicant. He said, "Since all the world must be destroyed, I seek an uncorruptible refuge." In other words, a refuge beyond old age, sickness and death. The response of Gotama to the fourth sight was, we may say, one of Shraddha. A Sangharakshita, I think, describes Shraddha as the ultimate in us responding to the ultimate in the universe. I think it's a fantastic translation of Shraddha. So a profound Shraddha had been stirred in the young prince's heart by the vision of the fourth sight. And this experience of Shraddha, when we know that there is a deeper meaning to be discovered, not contained within the conventional offerings around us, is something that perhaps we've all experienced, and this explains why we're here today. Shraddha can be uplifting and joyous. You know, that's when we know that there is something which can address the deepest longings in our heart. When I was 14, I had such an experience. I didn't know what it was, but I knew that there was something which would be able to address the longings I had. And it can be triggered by nature, sitting in nature, an event, or bereavement, or a beautiful human communication. But it can also be extremely fragile, delicate, and easily smothered by our daily lives. But not so for Gotama. Shraddha had been stirred, and it was going to take him all the way to enlightenment. Throughout his journey to enlightenment, Gotama kept listening to this intuition, or Shraddha. He never gave up. He never lost confidence in himself and his intuition, in his Shraddha. He was motivated by the desire to understand and conquer the existential roots of human suffering. Now, this may have been largely self-motivated, as quests and pioneers often are. It's interesting, Edmund Hillary, he was a fantastic pioneer of our times, but he became very philanthropic after he conquered Everest. But after his enlightenment, after Gotama's enlightenment, the full welling up of compassion occurred and is expressed again and again in his teachings. Confidence in ourselves as spiritual practitioners can be problematic for some, but as I say, not for Gotama. If not all of us, at one point or another in our lives, sometimes in our spiritual lives, we can lose confidence in ourselves. sometimes it can be chronic. I have known many men who appear to me to have an effective and sincere connection with the Buddha and the Dharma, in particular, and also the Sangha, expressed on the basis of the Shraddha, which they respond to the Buddha and Dharma with. But they do not see this for themselves, and they are undermined by self-doubt and lack of confidence, again and again. But when you do see them blossom, when you do see Shraddha really blossom in somebody and take root, you see the confidence which they have in the Dharma really shine through, it's something quite beautiful. And I myself was in this category of chronic lack of self-confidence. And it took a comment, this was years ago, from a friend of mine called Sadaloka, who lives here now. I used to see him a lot, and I just used to express my doubt, not just in myself, but being able to practice the Dharma, but in the Dharma itself. And he just stopped me once, and he said, "Mark," as my name was, "the Dharma is in your blood." And that comment stopped me in my tracks, and it had a deeply profound impact upon me. I started to take myself really much more seriously as a Dharma practitioner. Sadaloka was a good friend, and he was witnessing something in me which I didn't see in myself. And that actually is one of the powers of the ordination ceremony itself as well. So back to the fourth sight. The fourth sight was a calling to Gotama, to which he emphatically responded to. James Hillman, the Jungian psychologist, writes, "Sooner or later, something seems to call us onto a particular path. Each person enters the world called." So Gotama had been called by this fourth sight of the mendicant to a spiritual solution to the previous three sights. And we make a commitment to spiritual life and practice. We might become a friend. We might start going along more regularly to the centre. We might become a mitra. We might even become an order member. On the basis of the realisation that spiritual practice or spiritual perspective is a necessity in our lives. It's not optional, it's a necessity. If you can live without it, then it's not a necessity. If you can live without meditation and friendship and study the Dharma and your connection with the Buddha, it's not a necessity in your life. And actually realising that the spiritual life, or spiritual practice and perspective, was a necessity in my life, that took my friends to actually point that out to me. I wasn't aware of that myself. As I say, it took Sadaloka in particular to point this out to me. But I'm really glad that he did, because, you know, pursuing the spiritual life has brought untold riches to my life. And I can see that so clearly. You know, for those of you who work outside the movement, probably you're the same. I can see it so clearly, what I have in my life through the Dharma, through the Buddha and through the Sangha, which other people really, really want, but they don't know what they're looking for. A lot of my colleagues are in that position. So my gratitude to people who have pointed out that the spiritual life was a necessity in my life is enormous. And that gratitude has grown as my, you know, as the fruits of, if you like, my spiritual life have grown. So an enormous sense of gratitude. So if you feel a magnetic force tugging you, that's what it feels like sometimes, calling you to something that is profoundly worth your life, and I underline worth your life. Life is very precious. Life is relatively short, and also we don't know when our lives are going to end. So what is worthy of this, of your life? But if you do feel something from your depths tugging you, then it might be some deeper, wiser you that's calling you to something which is worthy of your life. On a profound level, I mean, of course, we do other things, but I mean, on a profound spiritual level. And we respond to the call according to our conditioning, current responsibilities and temperament. There are those who seem to make very rapid changes soon after coming along to a centre, and perhaps you know one or two. Very soon they become a mitra, and even ask for ordination. However, if you're a tortoise, and I think I'm in this category, don't worry. Don't be undermined by the apparent pace of the hares. The tortoises amongst us, may have powerful but unconscious views that drive our pursuit of happiness and security, which must first be worked with before we can respond to our spiritual calling in a more wholehearted manner. And that's certainly been my case. In my own life, romance, finding security in career, position, money and respectability have all been very big and difficult working grounds for me. And they kind of had to be worked out before I could respond to the calling a bit more wholeheartedly. The Buddha himself recognised that different people progress along the spiritual path in different ways and at different rates of progress. He said, for some people, the spiritual life is easy to start with and easy later on. For others, it's easy to start with and difficult later on. For some people, it's difficult to start with and easy later on. And you can guess it. For some people, it's difficult at the beginning and difficult at the end. Not the Buddha's words, but worth it anyway. It's worth it. So being a tortoise can be painful. However, as I found out, as you see people apparently zoom past you. In comparison, the tortoise can feel stuck. But the tortoises must explore those confused bits that hold us back in order to free ourselves from them. And this takes time. And when you do work it out, it's a fantastic relief. It's fantastic. So I don't mind being a tortoise, actually, because it's sent me down to look at myself in more deeper way. The important thing, whether you're a tortoise or a hare, is just to keep putting yourself in supportive conditions. Go on retreat. Meditate regularly. I don't need to tell you all of this. Meditate regularly and intelligently, as I'll come on to later. Go to classes. Support classes. It's fantastic supporting classes and giving of your knowledge and experience. Go to events at your local centre. Develop effective friendship. And so on and so on. These constitute important supportive conditions. And if you keep doing this, then by the law of Pratijit Samuppada, the law of conditioned co-production, you will progress. That is the law. So, back to Gotama. He responded decisively, as I say, to his calling. At the age of 29, he entered the homeless life. He was determined and resolute, and as I said, loyal to this calling based upon Shraddha, to the point of death, if necessary. He left behind, and I'm really struck by this, the comforts, all the certainties of and the securities of household life. Here was a man who had a position in society. He was probably going to inherit his father's position. And he went forth from all that was secure and familiar to all that was not. Imagine what that must be like. He exchanged a house for the wilderness, effectively. And in ancient India, the wilderness was not a place you went. It was a place to be feared. And he knew this, I guess. He knew that he was going from this life of relative security to something which was completely insecure and also ridden with fear. The wilderness, it had bandits in. It had wild animals, snakes, big beetles, big spiders, and also terrifying demons. You know, the folklore was very strong at that time. There were terrifying demons in the wilderness. So, you know, hats off to Gotama. And at the incident of Gotama leaving home, and in doing so leaving his wife, his son and his father, can trouble some people who encounter Buddhism, particularly those who have responsibilities for partners and kids. Well, and I want to say just a couple of words about this, because whilst going forth and giving up is, of course, it has to be a necessary part of spiritual progress. It's common sense. For example, if we are going to develop concentration, then we have to leave behind the habit of unconcentration. Straightforward. We have to go forth from that perpetual habit to stay unconcentrated. So responding to our calling does not necessarily mean leaving home. I think, and perhaps more importantly, going forth in whatever situation you're in can be a metaphor for leaving behind all the habits and views that we cling on to so dearly and that are not conducive to spiritual life or spiritual progress. But nevertheless, we feel at home within them. They keep us in our comfort zones. So, for example, habits of unethical behaviour. You know, if we're going to progress and become kinder to other people, then we have to give up habits of unethical behaviour and of negative mental states, clinging on to negative mental states or negative views of ourselves or the world, and so on and so on. And you don't have to physically leave home to do that. You can do it right now. You know, you can do it on this weekend in your meditation. So just practice with sincerity and mindfulness and keep putting yourself in the best conditions you can and progress will happen. So, Gotama, you left home, and then he headed south to a metropolis where it was a main centre for holy men questing for truth. And he spent some time here, but he didn't like it. He didn't like all the jostling and arguing he witnessed. He said, "The debaters, they start disputes, calling each other fools, seeking praise and calling themselves experts. If they are criticised, they feel depressed. They get angry and seek the flaws in other opponents' arguments. Meanwhile, those who win praise feel elated, and that is their downfall, because they swell and grow arrogant." Interesting. So these were holy men, don't forget, but Gotama was not satisfied with what was going on. So Gotama, he left this community. Again, we have an instance of the Buddha, Gotama, leaving relative security. Gotama had to find his own way forward, and again through his story towards enlightenment, we find Gotama being alone. It seems to be an inevitable part of his journey. He wasn't interested in mere philosophy. He wanted to experience the truth, whatever that might turn out to be. Of course, he didn't know yet, but he knew it was there directly for himself. Now, I don't know about you, but I used to find knowledgeable people, sharp and rational, really compelling. So I think I'd have found this kind of situation which Gotama first went to rather compelling, actually. Working in scientific research, as I did for several years, I was often awed by some of the brilliant minds I met, and some of them were really brilliant, you know, Nobel Prize winners and so on. And I was seduced by some of them, by their intellectual elegance and pin-sharp analytical capabilities. Put a problem in front of them, the answer would come out, no problem. And I wanted to understand the world and the mind. I thought I could understand the world and the mind through the rational mind. I thought the rational understanding would bring me the happiness that I desired. I would find a solution to to things which troubled me on the level of the rational. But of course, it didn't. You know, the rational did not, you know, it's okay, but it's just a stepping stone. Dukkha or unsatisfactoriness in life just broke in again and again. Rational knowledge did not protect me from the pain of the many battles which I had with colleagues, because in science you've got superegos go bouncing off each other like that a lot of the time. It didn't protect me against the pressure to keep ahead of my competitors in the US or Canada or where they were. It didn't protect me from the hassle of winning grants to fund my research. It didn't protect me from the fear of flying. I used to do a lot of flying. It didn't protect me from the visits to the dentist. It didn't protect me from the pain of failed relationships. And slowly but surely, it kind of dawned on me that intellectual understanding was not enough. It did not penetrate to the source of dukkha. And this is probably what Gotama experienced as well. Rational understanding was not enough. It wasn't going to get him anywhere. Intellectual titillation, yes. Deep emotional, spiritual understanding, no. So if the Dharma is really going to have an impact upon our lives, it cannot remain at the intellectual level only. It must penetrate deeper into our being. And this point has been made again and again by Sangharakshita, the founder of this movement. He says, and many of you will know this, you've heard this quote, he says, find emotional equivalents to our intellectual understanding of the Dharma. And in the Buddhist tradition, we find the teaching of the three wisdoms, where by first of all, we listen. So we really hear the Dharma. We study the Dharma. We get our facts right. And we start to say, oh yeah, we start to make the connections between the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path, and so on. So that's the first level of wisdom. Then we reflect. We hear that all things are impermanent. Oh yeah, of course, that is really easy to understand intellectually. Of course things are impermanent, of course they are. But we have to drag it deeper into our being. So we reflect upon all things are impermanent. Where's the evidence for that? Where's the evidence? Okay, it's all around me. And so on. So we really reflect upon what we've heard and or studied. We turn it over persistently. And finally we meditate. Or we become. We really see for ourselves the truth of particular aspects of the Dharma. We really see for ourselves the truth of impermanence, for example, by really meditating upon it deeply and persistently for long periods of time. So, back to Gotama. He left the community of religious philosophers and joined the meditative tradition. His first teacher taught him the Upanishads, which state that the meaning of life is to be found by becoming one with Brahma, with God, and that with each person there is a soul that can be found in meditation, which is the same as God. Gotama soon mastered all that his teacher could teach him, and he enjoyed talks about the enjoyment of the bliss of deep meditation. Despite this, however, Gotama still felt dissatisfied. It was just another experience. The dhyanas he was experiencing were just another experience. Intuitively, he knew that he had to go further. He hadn't found what he longed for. And the methods given to him by his teacher, his first teacher, and also his subsequent teacher, they weren't wrong. They were just simply inadequate. They weren't fit for purpose for what Gotama was trying to get to the bottom of. But how easy it would have been for Gotama to have been consumed with the bliss of meditative experiences in a respected position, because this teacher offered him the co-leadership of his group of disciples. So Gotama could have easily stayed put. He was enjoying blissful meditation and he had a position, if you like. But in the Brahmajata Sutta, the Buddha gives a long list of the views that distort and sidetrack spiritual life. An intoxication with higher states which we can experience in meditation are amongst them, which is quite interesting. We can think that because we're experiencing these wonderful states in meditation, that we have made substantial spiritual progress. That may be so, but we can also mistake states which still arise merely as a consequence of favourable conditions for significant and permanent spiritual progress. There's a great test for that. You get absorbed in meditation retreat, you go back to your situation, and within a minute you're getting angry. You know, to me, that's not permanent spiritual progress. But there's also another danger here. We engage sincerely in spiritual practice, meditation, and ethics. We feel stronger in ourselves. We feel more positive, more confident, and more content within our own skins. And also, we can start to becoming more attractive to other people. And I don't mean, other people as in potential sexual partners. I mean here whole range of people, including potential employers. The danger here is that we can start becoming complacent, and I know this one because I've been there. I'm all right, actually, Marshada. You're doing all right. Well, maybe I am, but I also notice complacency. I can coast on the fruits of my practice and think that I'm more evolved than what I am. Danger, danger, danger. Or perhaps we realise that actually all we wanted to do was just to be a bit happier anyway. We're not, and that's enough for us. We're not really interested in insight into the nature of reality. We're not interested in transforming our consciousness, really. And that's fine, you know, if that's all that we want, that's fine. Just be honest with yourself and just keep enjoying those states. So, back to Gotama. After leaving his first teacher, he found another, and under this second teacher's guidance, he reached an even higher level of meditation, beyond that he'd reached previously. He attained to a state known as the sphere of neither the perception or non-perception. But again, this was not enough. Even this deeply profound experience, which goes beyond perceiving and non-perceiving, was not enough. Gotama realised that he'd gone as far as he could, and he knew, based upon Shraddha, that there was further to go. His intuition and Shraddha were not satisfied. And again, despite being offered to co-lead the group by this second teacher, he refused. And again, very compelling to stay put, I would say. So once again, Gotama could have coasted. He could have coasted. He was enjoying these very absorbed meditative states. And again, he had this position responsibility. He could have just coasted. He could have easier settled down into a position of respect and influence among his teacher's disciples. The tendency to settle into comfort zones, and as probably all know, is extremely powerful. It's an extremely powerful trait in the human mind and can be very, very hard to throw off. But, however, Gotama was committed. He would not cease his quest until he had discovered the profound truths, what he intuitively knew he needed to liberate him completely from the deep existential unsatisfactoriness he experienced. And I think it's just really important to underline, again, the fact that Gotama decided to move on again. He was alone again. But he was so compelled by something which he knew he had to find, but he wasn't finding it, even with his second teacher. So next, Gotama joined the tradition that sought to free the spirit through self-mortification. He became an ascetic. The austerities he undertook for several years were extreme, and I'm not going to list what they were, but they left him emaciated and weak, and also famous throughout the land. Gotama the ascetic can do this. He was top bard. But that even so, they brought him no closer to his goal. And the Buddha said, "By this grueling penance, I have attained no distinction higher than the human state. Might there be another way to enlightenment? I thought of a time when my Shakyan father was working, and I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unprofitable things. I had entered upon an abode in the first meditation, which is accompanied by thinking and exploring with happiness and pleasure born of seclusion. I thought, might that be the way to enlightenment? Then, following that memory, there came the recognition that this was the way to enlightenment. Then I thought, why am I afraid of such pleasure? It is pleasure that has nothing to do with sensual desires and unprofitable things. Then I thought, I am not afraid of such pleasure, for it has nothing to do with sensual desires and unprofitable things. I thought. It is not possible to attain that pleasure with a body so excessively emaciated. Suppose I ate some solid food, some boiled rice and bread. So he did. But what I find intriguing is, what was it about this particular dhyana, which the Buddha recollected from when he was a child, that Gautama had effortlessly stumbled upon in his youth, that rather than being a dead end leading to a merely pleasant state of consciousness, which his previous meditation teachers had led him to, became the basis for his great awakening to the nature of reality? What was it about this particular dhyana? Because the Buddha clearly experienced dhyana, or other types of dhyana, as an ascetic, and also under his two teachers. So what was it about this one which effortlessly arose in him when he was about 10, or however young? Now, there are plenty of accounts given by the Buddha in the Pali Canon which give us a kind of a clue as to what type of dhyana can lead to or is important to support the unfolding of enlightenment. And in the suttas, the Buddha uses evocative images to describe the different dhyanas which he found useful. And one of them, the first dhyana, which I think some of you are quite familiar with, the image which he uses is you've got a pile of soap powder on the left, and on the right you've got a volume of water so precise that when you mix the two together, the soap powder is completely absorbed into the water, and there's no excesses. There's no crumbs of soap powder left. Everything is completely absorbed. The water mingles perfectly with the soap powder. So this for me gives me a clue as to what type of dhyana the Buddha was advocating. And it seems to me to be a process of integrating ourselves, drawing ourselves and our energies together. Not through force, not through will, not through pushing the tongue to the roof of our mouth, as the Buddha did as an ascetic, but intelligently opening up to our experience, as we'll see later, and drawing that into meditation in a sensitive and receptive manner. So Gautama saw, through his remembering of the rose apple tree experience, the way to liberation was not through super will. And again, I was terrible. When I first started meditating, I used to meditate like that because I was so determined to get concentrated and mindfulness agreement. But it didn't work. But it was, Gautama saw that it's through the deepening of concentration, samadhi, in a more appropriate manner that brought a profound awareness and a deep, blissful and powerful harmonising of the energy of his mind. He could not bend the mind into submission as he had tried. Liberation required the marshalling of his entire mind, heights, depths, to the sides and so on, in all 10 directions. And the ensuing pleasure and bliss that arose as a result of profound concentration and dhyana were to be enjoyed and not rejected. And so for us, it's important that we enjoy meditation. I know meditation can be a real struggle at times, but we can actually actively seek enjoyment in our meditation, and I think that's really important. It's important that we enjoy study. It's important that we enjoy friendship and don't see it as a chore. It's important that we find ways of enjoying puja, and so on and so on and so on. We are pleasure-orientated beings. We are driven by pleasure, I think, for most of us. So if we have pleasure in what we're trying to do in our spiritual lives, so much for the better. If we don't have pleasure or enjoyment, we'll just dry up and we'll just dry up. So if there's a little enjoyment in your meditation, as I say, try looking for it. When you sit down to meditate, try looking for any senses of pleasure in your body before you meditate. If your spiritual life is feeling drab and it doesn't float your boat, well, try actively seeking sources of inspiration, because there's something in you which is responding to the Dharma. And as I said earlier, that something can be extremely fragile until it's better embedded in your being. source of inspiration might be to go and meet a friend, go for a walk, go to a class, go just turn up at a class and support a class, read some Dharma, listen to a talk on free Buddhist audio. I really recommend that, or video sangha. So if things are feeling a bit drab, listen to something or do something. But and by the same token, we cannot force our spiritual life, as I said, be it meditation, ethical practice, friendship, much as we'd like to, especially if we are goal-orientated. We need to, but we, what I've learned over the years as somebody who was as extremely goal-orientated is that I just got to relax. I just had to relax and have faith and confidence in that putting myself in conditions which supported, you know, the unfolding of this fragile shraddha, that was enough. Forget the goal. Just enjoy the unfolding process of in meditation or in friendship or in seeing the powerful effect of ethics on your work, on my work colleagues or whatever. That was enough. The goal will look after itself. You know, I don't need to worry about it. So, back to Gotama. I will be finishing shortly. Leaving his ascetic friends, who, by the way, had left him in disgust with him taking food, Gotama returned to the wilderness alone. And I mean completely and utterly alone. After all, he had rejected all traditional wisdom. He had rejected the Upanishads. He had rejected everything which his first and second teacher and all the holy men which he first encountered. He had rejected all of that as a way to liberation. So he was literally completely alone. He had nothing to rely upon apart from himself now. His friends had gone, all the traditional wisdom texts, they weren't good enough. He was alone. And not only that, he was alone in a terrifying wilderness. And he entered the thick forests again. And he was familiar with the raw fear and dread that this can evoke from when he first left home. But nevertheless, he went back into the forests. And he describes his experience in the Sutta of the Fear and Dread, and I really recommend reading it. It's very interesting. On how, despite the fear he experienced, he viewed himself as being protected by samadhi, by concentration. Because he said, remote jungle thicket resting place in the forest are hard to endure. Seclusion is hard to practice, and it is hard to enjoy solitude, presumably partly because of the fear and dread. One would think the jungles must rob a bhikkhu of his mind if he has no concentration. So in other words, the Buddha's concentration protected him from the terrible consequences of fear and dread. Interestingly, he also said that he was protected in seclusion by an ethical mind. And I think this is really, really important and worth pondering on. It's outside what the remit of this talk, but it's really worth pondering upon what the Buddha meant when he said that the ethical mind can protect us in our lives. So the last stages of the Buddha's journey to enlightenment were dedicated to the mindfulness, basically. He was watchful over his own mind, exploring and pursuing what was useful and not pursuing that which was not. So Gotama sought liberation from the unenlightened mind by intensely and persistently examining it. He was not trying to make it into something else anymore. What he was trying to do was he was trying to learn from whatever arose in his mind. And I think that's really important. He was trying to learn from whatever arose in his mind. And after a period of aloneness in the forest, watching his mind with mindfulness, he realized that he was on the verge of something that he had sought 7 years previously when he left home. What would that, you know, just what would that have been like? But nevertheless, although he realised he's on the verge of something, his resolution was still there because he said, skin, sinew and bone may wither away, flesh and blood may dry up, but without the attainment of a complete enlightenment, I shall not leave this seat.